This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Good morning. It is good to have you with us. I'm Joel Hilliker. Do men have it better than women? We hear it all the time these days. Women are paid less than men for the same work. We live in a patriarchal system that privileges men. Some scientists tried to quantify the inequality between the sexes, and they measured it in 134 nations. You'll be surprised by what they found. In our second segment, we'll get caught up on what's happening in Hong Kong. The situation there is definitely getting more serious as China cracks down on a protest that's been going on for over 2 months now. We'll talk about what's at stake for Hong Kong and for China. In our third segment, we're going to talk about veganism, a diet that not only excludes meat, but all animal products. Is it healthy? And what's the thinking behind it? We'll talk with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about it. At the end of the program, we'll talk about the danger in boosting your child's self-esteem. In today's world, we tend to overpraise our children, but we have to see the spiritual side of the issue to make sure we're giving them perspective that actually helps rather than hurts them. We'll begin, though, by talking about sexism. Here's a montage of what Americans are hearing from the Democratic presidential candidates about the status of sex equality in our country today.
This toxic culture, this pernicious patriarchy in this country has to stop.
I wish that girls could fail as bad as men do and be okay. So many of us have gotten ourselves at the table, but we're still too grateful to be at the table to really shake it up.
Why is it that nothing's moving? Is it all about, you know, men protecting the status quo and the patriarchy?
Since 1963, when we passed the Equal Pay Act, we have been talking about the fact women are not paid equally for equal work. Fast forward to the year of our Lord 2019, and women are paid 80 cents on the dollar.
So yes, the game is rigged when women earn less than men for doing the same work. It's rigged. It's rigged. It's rigged. Rigged. The game is rigged against women.
The systemic devaluation of women in our society.
Women deserve to be paid as much as men, and they are not.
Right.
And this has not changed over decades.
Equal means equal. Equal opportunity for men and women in this country. And if you're not even in the Constitution, and women are not even mentioned in the Constitution, I think it's time to change that.
The pernicious patriarchy has to stop. Is it true? What's the evidence to support what these individuals are saying? Those are some strong accusations they're making. How much worse is it for women in this country than for men? Is there any way to measure it? Well, a group of scientists wanted to try to answer that question. Researchers from the University of Missouri and the University of Essex in the United Kingdom decided the best way to get a handle on this problem is to find a way to quantify it. They wanted to measure sexism, put a number on it. So they came up with the Basic Index of Gender Inequality, or BIGI. This is a global scale to measure inequality between the sexes. I only saw a news report about this last week, but the report was actually published January 3rd, 2019 in PLOS One. This is one of the world's leading peer-reviewed journals on science and medicine. And this says the new Basic Index of Gender Inequality, BIGI, focuses on three factors: educational opportunities, healthy life expectancy, and overall life satisfaction. So they calculated these BIGI scores, BIGI scores, for 134 nations representing 6.8 billion people. And these efforts to create an unbiased, reliable index to show gender inequality found that in poor countries, women are worse off. Their opportunities for education are often limited. Their satisfaction with life is lower than men. These researchers found a relative disadvantage for women in 43 countries. And these are just a few of the countries that are at the bottom of the list: Chad, Benin, Liberia, Yemen, Mali, Lesotho, Mozambique, a lot of African countries, Ethiopia, Pakistan, a lot of Muslim countries. And in these countries, there are real problems with the way that women are treated. Now, if you're a clear-thinking person, that's probably about what you'd expect. If you're someone who's been trained to think that Muslims and people in other religions and countries are far more enlightened than Westerners, you might dispute these findings. But this is what they found. And I'm sure if you talked to women in those countries, you would be see just how realistic that picture is. Now, what about richer countries? What about the West? What about America? Are women worse off than men in this country? Well, these researchers found that in the developed world, the situation is actually reversed. Men are actually worse off than women. David Geary led the study. He's a professor of psychological sciences at the MU College of Arts and Science. And he said, surprisingly, our new measure indicated that men are, on average, more disadvantaged than women in 91 countries compared with a relative disadvantage for women in 43 countries. So by their measure, in rich countries, women are better off. They have better educational opportunities. They lead longer, healthier lives, or they have higher overall life satisfaction. And in many cases, like the United States, all three of these factors favor women. Now, how is this possible when the whole system is supposedly rigged against women? Well, the study that was published in PLOS One says we haven't been measuring things correctly. The way these things are typically studied poses problems that distort reality. This is from the study itself. Apart from political agendas, research on gender inequality has also almost exclusively focused on issues highlighted in the women's rights movement. Issues disadvantaging more men than women have been understudied and are not heavily weighted, if at all, in widely used measures of gender inequality, such as the highly cited Global Gender Gap Index. Further, the Global Gender Gap Index, the GGGI, truncates all values such that no country can, by definition, be more favorable for women than for men. For details, see below. So this is very interesting. They're only measuring half the picture, and so lo and behold, they're finding disadvantages for women all over the place. This study continues. As a result, existing measures do not fully capture patterns of well-being and disadvantage at a national level. This is an important oversight, as there are issues that disproportionately affect boys and men. Among the many examples are harsher punishments for the same crimes and an overrepresentation, 93% worldwide, in the prison population, compulsory military service. The large majority of homeless people without shelter are men, higher levels of drug and alcohol abuse, higher suicide rates, more occupational deaths, underperformance in schools, and men are more often victims of physical assault in general and within schools, thus limiting educational opportunities. Men are also overrepresented in occupations that are risky, for example, exposure to toxins and physically taxing, such as frontline military duty, firefighting, mining, construction, or sewage cleaning. So, pretty interesting points here. There are plenty of areas in modern life where men have it worse off. And really, if you go back in history, this has been the case throughout human history. Even when you had men who were more in positions of power, they also just did a lot more of the dangerous jobs, and they were thrown into harm's way a whole lot more frequently than women. And even to this day, virtually all over the world, even in countries where men are more advantaged than women, women tend to have longer lifespans than men. But people want to cherry pick areas where women don't perform as well and try to explain every discrepancy as being caused by sexism and discrimination against women. This is the way they've come to view every problem in society. Everywhere they see differences, they want to blame discrimination and bigotry. Well, the reality is there are many factors that contribute to differences and inequalities. They are inherent in human existence. And the people who say they want true equality will never attain that goal. You can't. Not even if you use the most draconian, authoritarian means and weapons that are available. Earlier this year, the U.S. women's soccer team decided that they'd had enough of the inequality in their sport. They decided that they should receive the same amount of money or more than the men's soccer team because they win more games. They filed a sex discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation. Now, this got a whole lot of support from politicians. They were very excited about it. The presidential candidates weighed in on it. Senator Chuck Schumer said this: the women make just as much of a sacrifice, put in just as much mental and physical energy, absorb just as much risk of injury as the men who play for our national team. Yet when you break it down, a woman's national soccer team player earns a base salary of $3,600 per game, while a men's player earns $5,000. So they say things like this. It's a good applause line. For ignorant people, the implication is the only reason they make less is because of sexism. But here are some irrefutable facts that happen to be very pertinent to the question. The Women's World Cup generated $131 million in revenue this year. The Men's World Cup generated $6 billion. That's a pretty big gap. Now, you can blame that on whatever you like, but the fact is people want to watch men's soccer a whole lot more than they want to watch women's soccer. The same is true of basketball and football and baseball and every other sport. We don't compensate people. We don't compensate athletes based on how much sacrifice they make or how much mental and physical energy they expend or how much they risk injury. We compensate based on how much money their contributions bring, just like we do for everybody in a free economy. That's the way a free economy works. You can't arbitrarily decide what someone's pay should be based on virtues that you choose. If something doesn't make money, it doesn't make money. If someone's business isn't creating paying customers, it doesn't matter how much sacrifice or energy or risk they're taking, it doesn't pay. Now, if you want to assume that it's sexism that makes people want to watch men's soccer more than women's soccer, think about this. In 2017, the women's national soccer team played an under-15 boys team, the FC Dallas U15 Boys Academy team. This is boys 14 years old and younger. And the U.S. national women's soccer team lost that game 2-5. So if you were following the U.S. women's soccer team through the World Cup this summer, you were watching a team that would very likely lose to virtually any competent college or high school boys soccer team in the country. That is not sexist. That is reality. Just look at what transgenders are doing to women's sports right now, and you know there's a huge difference between men and women and their ability to play sports at a high level. And that's why we have two different leagues in every sport there is, that you have women playing women and men playing men. Is it possible that could explain the pay gap, that it's not sexism, it's not a toxic, pernicious patriarchy? In fact, the women who were earning $3,600 per game received a far larger share of the revenue that their sport generated than the men who received $5,000 per game. Far, far higher share of the revenue. If Chuck Schumer or those Democratic presidential candidates really care about women's rights, why are they fighting on this battlefront? This study says if you want to find disadvantaged women, look at the developing world. Where are the feminists seeking redress for their aggrieved sisters in Nepal and Morocco and Angola and Nigeria and India? They're not interested in that. People keep talking about the pay gap between men and women. Why is there a pay gap? Is it because of sexism? Well, there are many factors that affect pay, as we just saw in the example with the women's soccer team. The people talking about a pay gap ignore every factor except sex. They ignore the different roles that work tends to play in men's and women's lives. Many women prioritize other things over their career, which is fine, which is wonderful. They prioritize family or flexibility or personal fulfillment more than men tend to. They're less likely to move for a job. They're likelier to decline a promotion. They tend to gravitate toward lower paying careers. They tend to work fewer hours. The U.S. Census Bureau says that full-time men average 2,213 working hours a year, and the average full-time woman works 1,796 hours a year. Men tend to focus more on pay and sacrifice in those other areas, family and flexibility and personal fulfillment and so on. So if you ignore differences in occupations and education and experience and seniority and hours worked and several other factors, guess what? You're going to find a pay gap. As Thomas Sowell said, if it was true that you could plug a woman into a position for 80 cents to the dollar as compared to a man, every employer would just hire all women. They'd make a whole lot more money that way. But it's not true. The pay gap is a myth that is exploded when you examine it with facts. The facts are clear and irrefutable. So why do we keep hearing about the pay gap? Because it is politically useful. With any social justice crusade like this, it doesn't matter how much progress they make. There's always more work to do, quote unquote. They just change the standard. They change the definition of equality. Again, if they were really concerned about women's rights, they'd be trying to help the lives of women who truly are disadvantaged in these basic areas. There are countries that weren't even a part of that study, like Afghanistan, where women are still forced to wear burqas and have their girls forced into arranged marriages with old men. That's real inequality between the sexes. It's like I was saying last week about real threats versus fake threats. We need some perspective here. But the people who focus instead on the supposed sexism in America, they want to create grievances. They want to manufacture problems and stir people into discontentment, even if they have to ignore reality, even if they have to lie to do it. If they saw this study, they would push it aside. It wouldn't change their approach. They would say it was biased, or they'd come up with some other excuse to deny it or bury it. They're not interested in the truth on issues like this. But here is some truth. God made men and women. He made us male and female, and he did so for a beautiful reason. And when we study into why God did that, we see there was design and purpose and strategy in it. We see that we are heirs together of the grace of life, that we have equal opportunity to please God, equal opportunity to attain the kingdom of God. We see that neither male nor female is superior or inferior. There is neither male nor female in Jesus Christ. But we also see that God intends men to fulfill one role within the family and within society, and for women to fulfill a different complementary role. And it's a very beautiful design in all of it, that it's something that society fights against. All these people who are complaining about the pernicious patriarchy and the evils of inequality, well, they disagree with God. But the fact is, whenever we fight God, we lose. Society loses. Our society has been working so hard to guarantee equality, and here we've created a situation where men are disadvantaged, and people are still talking almost as though we're the ones who are putting women in burqas and straitjackets. But here's what God says. He doesn't just say that women have comparative advantages to men or that men are slightly disadvantaged. Isaiah 3:12 is a prophecy for our day, and God says, "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them." This is what our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flory, wrote in No Freedom Without Law. Families reject the rule of God. The Bible prophesied in Judges and Isaiah 3:12 that women would rule and children would oppress the families today. We may call our marriages a 50-50 rule today, but God says the women rule. Now, of course, people say, no, that's not true. And they'll protest that. But then you see jokes about it all the time. The stereotype of the man who acts like he's the boss, but we all know who the real boss is. We know the truth. We can recognize the truth in that prophecy. The way that these researchers are measuring sex inequality, it's useful in some ways. But what we really need to strive for is for both men and women to attain their full potential as God intends. We don't need to be comparing ourselves to each other. We need to be putting our whole effort into fulfilling the role God has given us to do.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
The situation in Hong Kong is growing more serious as China cracks down on a protest that has been going on for over 2 months. We'll hear what's at stake for Hong Kong and for China in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
Demonstrators in Hong Kong have now entered into their 10th week of protests. And on Sunday, a massive group of them occupied the Hong Kong International Airport. This is one of the world's busiest airports, and it was a major disruption that canceled all flights out of Hong Kong. But the mood of the protesters, at least initially, was optimistic. Here's a clip of them singing in the airport. That's the song, "Do You Hear the People Sing?" It was written for Les Miserables, a musical about the revolutionary period of France. So the protesters of Hong Kong have made this one of their anthems, because they see parallels between the people in Les Mis, who fought for revolution, and their own struggle against China. The protesters say Beijing is not listening to their voice. The people are crying out, but China doesn't hear their message. And their message over the weeks has broadened and become more urgent. It began as a protest against an extradition treaty that would make it easier for China to bring criminal suspects in Hong Kong to the mainland to stand trial. The Hong Kongers protested that because China's judiciary is notoriously corrupt. Fear of being subjected to this corrupt Chinese court system is what has driven 2 million Hong Kongers into the streets in recent weeks. And Hong Kong's total population is only about 7.3 million. So that's a colossal proportion of the total, about a quarter of all the people. And as the weeks have gone on, the demonstrators have begun broadening their protests to be against China's general encroachment on Hong Kong's affairs. Back in 1997, when Great Britain handed Hong Kong over to Chinese rule, China promised to let Hong Kong's government and people have a high degree of economic, political, and judicial autonomy for a period of 50 years. But China's been breaking this promise and inserting itself into Hong Kong's affairs more and more over the years. And now its encroachment is ubiquitous in most every facet of government and life in Hong Kong. So the protest movement has broadened to be against China's broken promise and to call for free elections and democracy. Some protesters are calling for regime change and for Hong Kong to be made an independent, democratic, separate country. So the protesters' demands are growing more significant. Their cries are growing louder. And in some cases, such as with occupying the Hong Kong International Airport, these protests are happening in ways that are deeply provocative to China. Here's a clip from Einar Tangen, a China political analyst based in Beijing, speaking with Martin Dennis on Monday. And he's speaking here about the protesters' decision to occupy the airport specifically, and also just about the general increase in their movement's intensity.
Well, it's very provocative. I mean, this is more than just civil disobedience. They're really impacting the economy of Hong Kong. Remember, Hong Kong is one of the biggest destinations in the world. It hosts just a huge number of persons. If you think 7 million people who are residents there, and you have over 30 million people who are visiting on a yearly basis, this could have a very big impact on the Hong Kong economy. And it's a situation which it seems to be fast deteriorating.
Right.
This is not the situation yesterday when they were just standing by.
So the situation is increasingly volatile. On Sunday, 54 people were injured when police in the airport started using batons and tear gas on those protesters. The youngest wounded protester was 8 years old. The oldest was 56. So these are not just university students. And one female protester lost her right eye in this crackdown and had her nose shattered. So it's becoming more and more violent, and China is pressuring Hong Kong authorities to use a heavier hand to restore order. China has also begun to ratchet up its rhetoric about the situation. China is now labeling the movement as a color revolution, and it's calling the protesters terrorists. China is also increasingly blaming the United States for these protests. It's an absurd claim, but it's fairly standard for the Chinese leadership, instead of doing some soul-searching about what they might be doing wrong that caused the protests, instead of that, Beijing is insisting that the people in Hong Kong couldn't possibly have any legitimate problems with China, so this must be America stirring up chaos to try to weaken China. It must just be part of U.S. President Donald Trump's all-pressure tactics of negotiation in the trade war. So it's a ludicrous claim, but if China continues to blame these protests on America, that could help Beijing legally justify a military intervention in Hong Kong. Here is Einar Tangen once again.
Well, there's Article 18 under the Basic Laws, which allows the Hong Kong government, if they feel that they need help in restoring a civil society, they can ask for the PLA to come in. But there's another option as well. If China, the mainland, sees this as a foreign interference, then they would be allowed to come in because it would be defense of the nation.
And it does look like a Chinese intervention could be near. Just yesterday, China began amassing dozens of military vehicles in the city of Shenzhen, which neighbors Hong Kong. China's state-owned media website, The Global Times, released a video of this, showing dozens of military trucks and more than a dozen armored personnel carriers, and they are now amassing them just a short distance away from Hong Kong. China officially says this is for military exercises, but it's clearly a signal to the Hong Kongers that China is not afraid to use force if the situation continues to deteriorate. If civil society breaks down, and if the airport continues to remain unusable, and if local authorities are unable to restore order, then China could very well roll into Hong Kong and put these protests down with force. So the situation is volatile, and it's a very important flashpoint to keep a close eye on, and the importance actually goes beyond just geopolitics. This situation in Hong Kong also has significance in terms of Bible prophecy. When we last discussed the prophetic significance of the Hong Kong situation on Trumpet Hour, we talked about the times of the Gentiles prophecy, recorded in Luke 21. That prophecy is about a shift in global power away from the Israelitish nations of America and Britain mainly, and toward non-Israelite Gentile powers, including China. And since Hong Kong used to be thriving under British control, and now it's languishing under Chinese control, this situation does show that the world is entering into the outer edges of those times of the Gentiles that the Bible said would happen just before Christ's return. And with Hong Kong, there's another, even more specific prophecy that is also being fulfilled here. And that is about sea gates. That's a term for maritime choke points and ports that allow access into important oceanic waterways and seas. And there's a prophecy recorded in Genesis 22:17 in which God promised that the descendants of Abraham would come to possess the gates of his enemies. These descendants are mainly the peoples of Britain and the U.S., so that's a remarkable prophecy that was fulfilled during the colonial era when, by God's blessing, Britain and the U.S. came to control virtually all of the world's main maritime gates. These included the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal, Cyprus, Sri Lanka, and of course Hong Kong. Hong Kong's location makes it a gateway port into the South China Sea. Around 30% of the world's maritime commerce sails through this sea, so it's a key maritime region. And just the fact that the British came to possess this strategically located territory was part of the fulfillment of that prophecy in Genesis 22. And there's a separate prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52 that says the British and Americans would later lose the sea gates that they had possessed. So with Hong Kong, that happened in 1997, when the British handed the territory over to China. At that historic time, in 1997, late Trump columnist Ron Fraser wrote about the handover and what it signified for Britain. He wrote, quote, "With the end of British rule in Hong Kong, we see the final act performed in the closure of an empire, a God-given empire." So that was a colossal loss for Britain, and it was also a tragic loss for the people of Hong Kong, which is evident in the increasingly desperate protests that are happening there now. And because of this Seagate part of the equation, the handover of Hong Kong from Britain to China was also a loss for global stability. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote about this in the July 2016 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. He wrote, quote, "Britain actually gave the South China Sea prize of Hong Kong to China. And now that U.S. military presence in the area has been drastically reduced, China is claiming the entire South China Sea as its own. And whoever controls these vital sea gates controls one-third of the world's maritime commerce. Everything is headed in the direction of war." End quote. So this is not just a matter for the people of Hong Kong. This is a situation that is destabilizing one of the busiest shipping lanes on the globe and eroding global peace. So that should concern each one of us. Each one of us should hear the people sing that song of angry men and understand that the British and American leadership that brought relative stability to the world for so many years is rapidly deteriorating. And we should understand that the nations that are filling the power vacuum are of an entirely different ilk. And seeing these developments and the Bible prophecies that are being fulfilled by them should also push us beyond concern. It should stir us to work toward getting to know God and His Bible that is being proved true by these events.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. It is remarkable to watch this situation develop and to just see China willing to take stricter and stricter measures. I saw some video footage of the streets of Hong Kong just absolutely empty. And it does seem like China is definitely showing itself willing to use more authoritarian measures. Closing down the airport, that's quite an extraordinary step. It's a very populated, well-traveled airport.
It is. It's one of the world's very busy airline hubs there. Almost anyone flying to various destinations in Asia would have a high chance of needing to have a layover there in Hong Kong. This is something that China is beginning to feel the heat on in a big way. It's happening in a way that is sending reverberations through the entire Chinese system at this point economically. And so I think the restraint that we've sort of seen from China, I'm not sure how much longer that could last.
Well, you could definitely see why it would try to use as minimal of that kind of force as possible, just so that it doesn't signal this authoritarianism that it wouldn't want to broadcast that any more than would be absolutely necessary. So you can see where it'd be in a bit of a hard point to try to get that balance right. But when you're looking at what it's trying to accomplish and looking at it even from the standpoint of getting control over the maritime trade and so on, it really has no choice in the its bigger strategic calculus.
Yes, that's right. The optics of a military intervention would be terrible for China. Right now, they're trying to sell themselves as a friendly power that everybody in the world should invite into their borders with the Belt and Road Initiative and other things. So that would be broadcasting the worst possible message for them right now, kind of a repetition of that Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989. But if China's hand is forced, then I think that even at the risk of those unfavorable optics, they would have to go in there and just assert political stability.
Yeah. Well, we do appreciate that, Jeremiah. Thanks for keeping us up to date on that. We've been talking to Jeremiah Jacques about the direction of these protests in Hong Kong against China. He's working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Veganism. 30 years ago, it was associated with hippies and animal rights protests. Today, it's become far more mainstream. Plant-based foods are a multi-billion dollar industry. But some advocates insist we all need to become vegans, that the entire global food system needs to be reformed. To talk about this, we have via Skype from British Columbia, certified holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian. Hello.
Hello there.
Veganism. Tell us, first of all, what is it? What do vegans eat?
Well, little known fact is that the term vegan was coined in 1944. So I actually looked that up, and it's actually the beginning of the word vegetarian and the end of it. So, and I guess they broke away from the vegetarian society and they formed their own society. And they chose, besides not eating meat, not to eat dairy or eggs or any other products of animal origin. So very much stricter. Basically no animal products, full stop. Nothing to do with it, no coats, no shoes, nothing. And anything having to do with the industry of dealing with animals. Now, it's not a lifestyle that's appealing to the masses, I would say, But marketers, what they've done now is they've used this very, this term that is actually brilliant. It's called plant-based.
Uh-huh.
And so you use vegan and plant-based interchangeably, and it's called a plant-based diet. And it just reframes veganism as less restrictive, more mainstream, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So now the buy-in is pretty big with millennials. I think about 73% the percentage says. And they'd be willing to pay more for a product if they know it's more transparent about ingredients and it's more ethically sourced. So mm-hmm. It's very important to young people like that. And so that's causing a lot of the supermarket chains and the restaurants and the fast food outlets to offer plant-based alternatives, foods that would appeal to vegans. And there's even what's called the Impossible Burger. It's just basically a lab-crafted burger that looks and bleeds and tastes like beef.
It bleeds like beef, even though it's plant-based. So I definitely want to get into just the health ramifications. What's the logic behind staying away from animals altogether?
Well, veganism tout themselves as the healthiest diet in the world. And that's because it's based on plants and animals. And, you know, first of all, to them, it's evil just to kill an animal. And as well, it's not healthy. So what they say is, look, the studies show that the more meat that you eat, the more you get cancer and the more you get heart disease. And that's just a grotesque cherry picking of data, because I'm reading studies and I'm seeing the exact opposite. And that where meat eating is actually good for the heart and it's good for keeping cancer away. There's so many nutrients in meat. And so we have this counter argument between meat eaters and non-meat eaters throwing these studies at each other, and you're saying, well, which one is correct, right?
Yeah.
So their thing is it's really a mishmash of ideas. It's bad for you, and we hate the fact that it's an ethical problem because we love animals. So they're not really choosing their main topic on it. They just say, we love all animals, no animals can be hurt. And that's really the basic gist of it, the ethical part. Because when I talk to vegans, it's always, I can't handle the fact that an animal is killed. And then it's bad for you.
Right. So so they're not using the health argument as the primary argument, but let's just talk about the health implications of eliminating animal products. All dairy, all eggs, any product that comes from an animal, these are all off limits. What does that do to our diet? How does that affect us if we go that route?
Well, basically, you have the nutritional value of cat food. I mean, it's not healthy for you. The reality is, if you take away all animal-based products, you have a nutritional bioavailability issue. And that means, say, iron, for example. And this is well known. I mean, you could argue this back and forth, but the studies show that iron is not absorbed as well from plant sources as animal sources. That's a fact. B12, vegans tend to be 50%, have 50% less B12 than meat eaters. Vitamins A and D, crucial to us, found almost exclusively in seafood, in organ meats, in eggs, and dairy products. You know, plants, by the way, only have the inefficiently converted precursor to vitamin A, and that's beta carotene. So that it's just not the same. And then you've got a lot of other nutrients like iodine, zinc, taurine, selenium, and even protein. I mean, you're not getting protein. So what are you relying on? You're relying on soy products. And then the problem with that is you've got all these hormone disruptions that come because you're overeating soy products. You know, and we're not even getting into fatty acids, the proper amounts that the body needs.
So let's go back to the issue of just food production, because this also seems to be a fairly strong argument for veganism, that in so many cases, animals, the way that they're farmed, and we were talking about fish farming a little while back, so much of animal food production really is unethical. It seems like they're not concerned about the health of the animals. And then there are, it seems, also just questions that come up about sustainability, the fact that it takes so much more resources, say, to grow, you know, a pound of meat versus a pound of wheat, something like that. What are the environmental considerations for this, or are there, how much is it a matter of, is it possible to sustain a large population with a meat, a diet that includes meat?
Well, it is. We've done it for thousands of years. And the fact is, most of the world would love to have as much protein as we do. They're starving for it. Go look in undeveloped countries. You give them some meat, they'll thrive. Bring them over here, and all of a sudden they look different, they act different, they have more energy. The fact is, and I agree, we're doing it wrong. Of course we are. Commercially, it's a grotesque way to treat animals. I agree. I'm on board.
Yeah.
Do I support that industry? No, I don't. You know, we don't need to do that to animals. It's greed, pure and simple. There's different ways to do that. You know, you can do there's what's called traditional rather than commercial meat production. So meat and dairy. And that's actually far more efficient than driving up demand for vegetable crops. If you had just plant-based sources of food, you know, that would actually require higher inputs of fertilizer and poisons and the indirect use of fossil fuels. It's actually a counterproductive argument. Traditional farming for thousands of years has worked. Yeah. Now, as soon as we put ourselves into these mega cities and we need to ship stuff in from outside, of course, you're going to go into commercial practices and greed. And then it gets even worse when we go international and we get meat from Poland and China and all of these places and their practices. And none of those are humane. But that doesn't mean that we can't say there's actually a traditional way to do it, a proper humane way, versus saying, no, it's always are bad because we don't like the fact that animals are getting killed. So there's the ethical part again. You can't really win the argument based on science and nutrition because you're always getting that thin wedge of ethical, the ethical part put in there. And so you always have this counter argument based on two facts rather than one. And so if I'm a meat eater, I do have the ethical part as well. I want humanely these animals treated humanely, of course. But I'll say it again and again, a cow isn't a pet. Mm. You know, for thousands of years, we've had animals that we've treated in a proper way, raised them, and then slaughtered them for food. And that's for the human race.
Yeah, you mentioned just the, say, fertility of the soil, the need for artificial fertilizers. If you remove the organic fertilizer that animals produce, which replenishes soil, then you end up having to resort to inorganic fertilizers or synthetic fertilizers.
Well, of course. I mean, animals are part of the cycle of life. So we say, well, you know, they have manure and the manure interferes with, you know, these emissions, and therefore we can't do that. And we just say, well, that's your argument and you can have it if you want. I just don't believe in it. You know,
the idea that global warming is being caused by methane production by farm
animals. Of course. Yeah. That's what they say.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course you got to take away all the animals, and then, you know, we're left with some kind of patty that's made out of a plant-based material and grown in a lab instead of a proper burger on our plate.
So the folks who decide this is what they want for themselves, anybody is free to make that decision. But it does seem like there is a strain among vegans that are really looking for more of like a global reform, and they're insisting on making these changes in order to prevent problems like what they perceive as the link between animal food production and global warming. What have you seen about that?
Right. So what we see in the news is, you know, it's the militant arm of veganism, really. It's always existed. And that's the people that are producing all the vandalism, the intimidation, the harassment, the crazy stuff, you know. And the nonviolent vegans really disassociate themselves from that. You know, they kind of poo-poo that. And both sides, essentially, though, they serve the same purpose. There's a propaganda that of trying to convert the world to veganism. So if you look at the news today, just looking at it and saying, where is all the vegan news coming from? What's driving it? And how many people are really practicing it? The Americans are only, I think, about 3% practice veganism. 3%. Yeah, if you look at the news and you look at nutrition news, about 90% is about plant-based, you know? And so we've taken aside the militant, really the militant arm of it, look at government sources, look at government, look at these big organizations like EAT. It's really a totalitarian approach to this where they want to control the production and the interference with a country's food supply. I looked at the CEO of Impossible Foods, Impossible Burger, Patrick Brown. I looked at one of his quotes and he said, the whole mission of the company is to replace the use of animals as a food technology by 2035. Hmm. Now, listen to the end part of it. And that is the most important mission in the world, full stop.
Wow. That's ambitious.
Now, well, my question is, where's your choice? Mm-hmm. What was my choice in this? You know, are we just pawns in this? The Eat Lancet report, that was one of the biggest reports out there. And really what this is, and it's the same thing, you know, buried within page 34 of this report, it says, the scale of change of the food system is unlikely to be successful if left to the individual or to the whim of consumer choice. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, I just get a vague hint of a militant approach here. This isn't a soft approach. This isn't a where we say, well, do you have a choice? You know, we're considered pawns in this, you know, and because the anti-animal agriculture narrative, it runs parallel to climate change. They have the same end means. They call for the end of meat production. They call for a meat tax. And it's really this cut of the same cloth. You know,
well, that's kind of the route that all of these kind of movements take, the utopian ideals that people aren't going to go after just because of the goodness of their hearts. The only way to bring it about is to enforce it through through authoritarian means.
Well, it's true. Now, if you really look at the statistics, the United States Environmental Protection Agency, they said 9% of U.S., if we're to believe the greenhouse gas emissions, 9% of the emissions is due to agriculture. And of that, animal agriculture is responsible for 4%. Hmm. Now, we're going to change the entire system for 4%. Yeah. You know, it just doesn't make sense to me. But what this looks like to me is just, it's a taxation. It's a willful changing of the system, of the food system. And it's just, they're trying to get people to bow down to a false environmental god, their god.
So just to wrap this up quickly, again, taking it back to the individual level, proper diet, just give us your view as far as keeping the balance correct in our diets.
Well, the only way we're going to get the truth in anything is to look at what the Bible says. And the Bible, you know, Mr. Armstrong always said, it gives us the foundation of knowledge. You know, and that's the truth that we have to look at. That should be our guiding principle. And the Bible actually tells us that we can have meat and enjoy the meat and just have an abundance of vegetables with it. There's nothing wrong with it, and other whole fresh foods, and avoid the stuff that's processed. That's really the key, a moderate approach to a whole food diet, and then the end result is a superior health.
All right, thank you very much, Jorg. We've been talking to certified holistic nutritionist Jorg Mardian about veganism. He's preparing an article about the subject for thetrumpet.com. Thanks for your time, Jorg.
Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
I am even more amazing than I thought. Today, I will remind myself that I am a marvel. These are a couple of the thoughts of the day found in a book called Today I Am Lovable, 365 Positive Activities for Kids. And they represent a myth that infects modern child rearing and education. It's a false idea intended to help our children that actually damages them. What is it? It's the idea that praise is not just the best, but in fact the only motivator for children. This idea saturates children's programs, interactive toys, and games. When a child does something right, rather than a simple, "That's right," they say, "Wow, you're really smart." American schools in particular emphasize self-esteem as the chief virtue, divorced from achievement or even effort. So children are routinely sheltered from the sting of failure, and therefore they're trapped in a fantasy world where bad behavior and poor performance have no negative consequences. Now, the kernel of truth in this myth is that children grow up and perform best in a positive environment, that an enduring climate of criticism can be withering. Of course, we want our children to be confident and well-adjusted and happy, but overpraise is not the way to get them there. In a book called The Feel-Good Curriculum, The Dumbing Down of America's Kids in the Name of Self-Esteem, Maureen Stout pinpoints several destructive myths that have taken root in our educational system, including these: high expectations damage self-esteem, evaluation is punitive, stressful, and damaging to self-esteem, discipline is bad for self-esteem, effort is more important than achievement, it is the teacher's, not the student's, responsibility to ensure learning. Let's face facts. High self-esteem is wildly overrated. Repeated studies have proven that bloated self-worth doesn't improve a child's academic performance. It doesn't strengthen his interpersonal relationships. It doesn't help him avoid self-destructive behavior. It doesn't translate into adult success. In fact, it often hinders a person in all of these areas. Is that really any surprise? A child raised to think he's a marvel just as he is? He has no motivation to improve. Stout makes a strong case that these ideas that infect our public schools from kindergarten through college lead directly to narcissism, a detachment from your community, rejecting absolute truth, and cynicism. And she also shows that there's a correlation with the dumbing down of curricula and grade inflation, a loss of motivation among teachers as well as students, an unmerited sense of entitlement, and the ridiculing of critical thinking skills. Do we really want our children thinking, "I'm even more amazing than I thought"? As one educator put it, who in the world wants to hang out with someone who thinks like that? Studies have shown that self-esteem can actually become self-delusion, a conviction that you're more popular, more capable, more loved than is really true. Such self-centered attitudes only alienate other people. And at the same time, almost paradoxically, the overpraised child can be addicted to approval from others. Children who are taught self-worth with no link to personal achievement generally face crushing shocks when reality finally comes knocking, challenging their artificially high opinions of themselves. As we approach adulthood, praise dries up. Life's trials get tougher. The overpraised child, having long been shielded from small failures, finds sudden big failures overwhelming. When we look at this issue spiritually, we see its sinister side. The originator of the self-esteem movement is Satan, whose heart, Ezekiel 28 tells us, was lifted up because of his beauty, who was obsessed with his own brightness. This spirit being, the prince of the power of the air, pumps our carnal human nature with his egomaniacal attitudes. In other words, our children already get enough training in loving themselves above all others without any prodding from misguided educators and overeager parents. God knows our vain proclivities. So he filled his Bible with warnings against flattery and insincere praise. A flattering mouth works ruin. A man that flatters his neighbor spreads a net for his feet, and so on and so forth. Now, that's not to say that praising our children is wrong, of course. We should think on what's praiseworthy and commendable. But empty, indiscriminate praise means nothing. Children should receive sincere, specific praise when appropriate. When they scrawl out a crayon picture of clouds, it's not honest to say, "That's gorgeous!" But you could easily say something like, "I like how you're using different colors," or, "Wow, you're learning how to draw on paper what you see outside." These kinds of conversations also lend themselves more to giving gentle guidance on how to improve the next time. If you handle it correctly, constructive criticism won't make our children flinch. We want them to accept criticism as a help to personal growth. It's a crucial part of life. Loving correction, graciously received, is one of life's greatest gifts. That's a lesson even our children can begin to understand. Rather than trying to inject our children with self-worth, we need to help them see reality. That's the way God helps His children. And the reality is this: you're a child. As you strive, you grow. You have a lot to learn, but I love you and I always will love you, even when you fail, as long as you never give up. Think about it. It's only when we recognize our own inadequacies that we can see the need to seek God's help, to live the right way, the way that will bring happiness. Jesus Christ told us, "Without me, you can do nothing." That's clearly the opposite of self-worth. In the end, our children will need to recognize deep in their heart that, like all human beings, they can do nothing without God. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from David Herbert Lawrence. "I never saw a wild thing sorry for itself. A small bird will drop frozen dead from a bough without ever having felt sorry for itself." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.